and welcome to Mental Health Insights. My name is Craig, and today I'm here with Jeremy Schumann. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Craig.
So Jeremy has decided that he wants to join us and help us understand a little more about something that I would say is actually more common. I think it's becoming more and more common as people become more and more aware of it. We're going to talk a little bit about OCD. So I just wonder, like, for you, Jeremy, let's say that someone is like, okay, I've heard of OCD, but I don't really have a good idea of what it is. If you were going to give them kind of like maybe a short answer to help them really capture it, what is something you'd tell them?
So I would say that OCD is obviously a psychiatric disorder that features a lot of anxiety, but sometimes not anxiety, sometimes more of a disgust reaction. And it's really characterized by a number of things: intrusive thoughts, thoughts that we wish would not pop into our head. And those sometimes look like the normal kind of worries that people think about. And sometimes they look like images that are scary, violent, sexual, taboo. Sometimes they're urges of those same kind of themes. And then those get obsessed about. So a patient will ruminate, will think about the meaning of those intrusive thoughts. And then they feel this anxiety or disgust, and they feel a need to neutralize that through some sort of compulsion. And those compulsions are either behavioral, that might be something really classic like hand washing to make sure I know the germs are off my hands, but that might be washing my hands for 30 minutes. Or they might be things that seem more magical, like I need to tap the four corners of the door before I walk through to make sure I'm going to have a good day. Or they might be things that are more mental. A person needs reassurance, and so they seek certainty in their head, overthinking the topic. And this could be overthinking one of these like magical, doesn't seem so real topics, or it could be the kind of everyday worries that we have. OCD is not a disorder of the content of what you worry about. It's the process about how you handle those thoughts. And so OCD can look like so many different things, looking like regular old anxiety that's just processed in a weird way into things that seem bizarre to the outside world.
Well, and I love that you said that, because I think that most people that might think of OCD, which actually I don't think so obsessive compulsive disorder is OCD. No, so many people think of this, and I know that even me before I got into this field would have thought of it as like, oh, those are people that are like scared of germs and stuff, like a really kind of narrow view. And I love how you lay that out, where it's actually, it can be much more broad, whereas someone has a type of anxiety and it can be very wide ranging, and it's how they process that anxiety. And especially if there's a compulsion that goes along with it, whether or not it's counting, or like you said, hand washing, or I think that the compulsions that people said, like you said, they could be anything. And whenever you're talking about that, the first thing that I went to, I don't know why, is like baseball. You know, people have certain superstitions that they need to do before they go out on the field or anything. And that, even me saying that out loud there, that kind of helps me understand that this can be much broader than what I would have even considered. So
I would say there's this change that happened from DSM-4 to DSM-5 as well, where in the DSM-4, patients had to recognize that their worries did not really make sense in the context of reality. And in DSM-5, now the worries can be about these everyday things, which makes it even more confusing for clinicians who don't have a lot of experience with all the different manifestations of OCD to see any sort of line between generalized anxiety and, you know, the superstitions that a lot of people do versus when this turns into another beast that we need to approach differently.
Well, actually, I think that's really important, because not only do clinicians listen to this podcast, but there's also just average people that listening to this, and they may listen to this and be like, yeah, this is something that I have, or this is something I've been diagnosed with. And if we're approaching an anxiety disorder versus approaching OCD, you said that we kind of have to approach it a little bit differently. Can you help us understand like how that approach might be different?
Yeah. For an anxiety disorder, let's say you're worried that you might get fired from your job and you have, you know, some kind of feeling that you're an imposter and that you're not really putting out good quality work. It might be really helpful for you to take a look at all the evidence, what some of the feedback that you've gotten,
right.
Have other people at your company been fired, and to notice when you're thinking about this uncertainty about being fired and to respond to that with all this evidence and reassuring yourself. But that's what OCD wants you to do. That maintains the OCD cycle through this thing called negative reinforcement. When we take away a fear, it makes it more likely that fear is going to show back up again. And so with OCD, we want to respond to those kinds of thoughts by accepting the uncertainty, by non-engagement, if anything, by poking back and say, yeah, I guess today's the day I'm going to get fired. I'm going to show up to work anyway and let it happen. And then when you don't get fired and you learn from that experience, that'll benefit you. Whereas if you went into the day saying, I know I'm not going to get fired, I reviewed all the evidence in my head, it may take me 30 minutes of being stuck staring at a wall in my head where I'm not working, I'm not processing my life, I'm not engaging with my family, I'm not paying attention to what I'm eating for breakfast. And then I'm more likely the next day to be trapped in that cycle again and again and again.
Right. So it sounds like that's an easy or a better way for someone to kind of identify whenever they are having like OCD versus what may be more, I don't know if you want to call it like traditional anxiety or anything like that. So if we're going to approach this, like if I'm someone that's sitting here listening to this and I'm like, okay, I'm starting to think that this anxiety I have is actually, maybe it's more OCD related. What's something that they can do to start helping them not only think about this differently, but just even approaching it differently?
So if someone's having that thought and they're wondering, is this OCD and what would that approach look like? I might suggest there's some really good YouTube channels with some therapists who are highly trained, who put out great information that I think really resonates with a lot of people, and it helps them make up their mind, so to speak. With OCD, we maybe never really make up our mind, but help push us in the right direction. So Nathan Peterson is a really excellent resource on YouTube. And then Natasha Daniels, she does more child oriented videos, super helpful. She talks directly to kids, and it can be hard for kids to put words to their worries, and
right.
can help people make sense of it a lot. So I would recommend first do some reading, do some research, and then consult with a therapist. And you don't have to figure this all out on your own.
Right.
And they might help point you in a direction of, you know, the next resource that would be interesting to you.
Right. Well, and I could imagine that a lot of times whenever people do suffer from OCD, this is something that entraps you in a lot of ways. And like you said, it kind of only gets more and more worse the more and more it gets reinforced. So I'm wondering, like, if someone's like, okay, I've looked at these resources, I definitely have OCD. I definitely kind of fall into that category. And they're like, okay, so I'm going to seek help, seek these resources, seek a therapist. What's something that they can start doing on their own to start to be really mindful of this part of them?
Good question. So to build self-awareness about it, this is kind of getting into what a therapist might direct you to do, but tracking your compulsions, putting down what the triggers are, or we might use the word proximal antecedents in the therapist community, but what happened right before you started compulsing, even considering that what we might consider what some people would call an obsession, where you're overthinking something, that's really a compulsion. You're trying to find certainty.
Right.
So recording what was happening, what was the time of day? Was I hungry? Was I tired? Did I forget my meds that day? Was I stressed about something else? And just time and place, and start making a list to be more self-aware of when it's happening. So
really narrowing down on some of these triggers is going to be something that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, let's say you start to narrow down on some of these triggers, what then?
So after you have identified what your triggers are, assuming you're working with a therapist on this, mm-hmm. or you're going through a self-help book, let me plug real quick also a couple great books, Jonathan Grayson's Freedom from OCD, John Abramowitz's 10 Steps to, I think it's called Undo OCD or 10 Steps to Freedom from OCD. You might, after making your list of compulsions, think of that as sort of a map that OCD has all of this territory in your life. And we're going to go for just one area of it first. And we'll pick out one situation, one type of trigger, one type of compulsion. And we'll try to knock out all the compulsions completely. And the way we'll do that is together with a therapist or with someone who doesn't have OCD who can help advise you on this. You're going to make a response prevention plan. You're going to make guidelines for these situations for in daily life when you encounter it. This is how we would approach it as if we didn't have OCD. And that's going to be challenging. So we might start kind of easy and work our way towards a more fully fledged comprehensive plan that eliminates all the compulsions in that area. And we would pair that simultaneously with the process of exposure. Exposure and response prevention is the gold standard therapy for OCD. And the exposure will look like seeing things, intentionally seeing things, in a planned way that are similar to the kinds of triggers that you see in real life, to give you an opportunity sort of in a vacuum to flexibly respond to this trigger, to choose a behavior that's not what OCD wants you to do. If anything, to poke back and make OCD more mad at you by doing it. And by doing the exposures and by having these RP plans for this area of your life, you can get closer and closer to approaching these kinds of triggers in this flexible way, responding to them in a way where you're behaving in line with your values. You're not doing what OCD wants you to do, but you're doing what your top priority is if you are able to mindfully connect, be into that wise mind state that DBT talks about.
Right.
What would I be doing with my time right now if I could wave a magic wand and this OCD was gone and I had great executive function and I could do what I want to do? That's what you want to be doing instead.
I think hearing you say this is so important, and I'm hearing this and like me as a therapist, I'm connecting some things that I know from other areas. And this kind of sounds like, let's say for example, that my OCD, my tendency for that is around every time that I touch the handle to my refrigerator, that I want to spray off the handle and disinfect it. So that I know that every time that I go into the refrigerator, I'm reaching a clean hand in there. So one of the things that I would do while working with a therapist or going through with somebody that doesn't have this, and you laid it out so specifically, right? Like you have to have this certain plan. And if I've identified this as a trigger for me, then I'm going to want to approach this knowing, all right, what is the other behavior that I want to do? And whenever I actually go through and do that, you said it's kind of like, I love what you said, that it's like poking at the OCD. And that makes so much sense to me, because for us, one of the parts of our brain, the basal ganglia, is actually responsible for all of our like unconscious processes around habits and habit formation. So we're actually directly trying to challenge that, this entrenched thought, and create a new pathway, which is something that's super hard. It's kind of like if I told you like, hey, I want you to go sit down in that chair, but I want you to sit down differently than you ever have before. Like in fact, you actually can never go back and sit the way that you did before in the chair. I want you to find a new way to sit in it. And I want you to intentionally go and do that every single time until you form that habit that you don't even think about doing, like sitting that same way.
Right. I want to absolutely agree with that. That's exactly what we're doing. And for the therapy nerds in the crowd, there's this big shift that happened in about 2008 in the anxiety disorders community that changed the way that we thought about dealing with anxiety, where it used to be saying we're going to break an association between these this feared thing and this neutral thing. We now say you don't really forget. You don't really forget that. What you do is you build a new memory. You do something differently. You reinforce that until it's accessible to you when you need it.
Right. I think that's so important because I think that, that's important for me to hear at least, and maybe a lot of people that are hearing this, because I think a lot of people get weirded out by coming to therapy because they're like, oh my gosh, like my memories and experiences, they're going to try to help me like forget them or not think about them. And what you just said is so affirming, like, no, we're just trying to help you so that your response is more accessible. So that's the thing that's automatic. It's not ever taking away something that's already there. It's giving you a different option that you can, that can be your go-to every time if you choose. And there's something about that that's so empowering, that we're helping you, you know, whenever you're helping people with OCD, you're helping them have a different response. And this could be over multiple areas, right? Because you said that, like, hey, we're working on this one OCD response, this one part of this. And if you have multiple, which I imagine is probably common, that like, all right, then after we have this one broken, then let's move on to this one to help you continue to have new responses.
Right. So we work on that one area of the map. And then when we have some good progress there, then we expand it out a little bit more and we try to keep the progress where we're at. We expand it out a little bit more. But the thing about OCD is because it's about process and not about content, the content area is fickle. And it often jumps around. And I was worried about touching my refrigerator and contaminating it. Well, now I'm worried that I might have harmed my child by yelling at them. And I'm obsessing about that. Well, no, this is a real concern. That fridge thing was silly. And not seeing that this is the same thing where I'm not able to accept uncertainty and just move past and respond the way that I want and say, maybe I did yell at my kid, but I'm going to treat them kindly in this moment. And we'll have to see what happens from there. And so when it jumps around, we're playing this like whack-a-mole game where we got this area, we move on to this area, it's popping up. Eventually we need to whack all the moles at once. And in the process of doing that, you're learning how to flexibly respond so that in the moment you can feel that uncertainty feeling and lean into it regardless of content. So if I'm working with a patient who's mild, we may not cover all the areas of the map. We might just get into how to flexibly respond. They have some progress in one area and they feel a whole heck of a lot better. For someone who's more severe, we might be working on the whole map and then dealing with things as they pop up and then continuously saying, this is how this is going to become your self-help plan. This is how you're going to flexibly respond when it comes up in the future.
You used a word there that I want to make sure that people kind of understand with like how you're using it. Use the word content. So for us, whenever we're referring to content, it'd be really easy for, especially us as therapists, because you know, we like to talk about things as part of what therapy is that you can come in and say, wow, I yelled at my kid the other day and I feel really terrible about that. Like I'm a bad parent. And we might sit there and talk about the implications of that or how to be a better parent or whatever, right? Or like how to manage your anger or anything like that. And that is the content of the situation without actually recognizing and making the connection that the underlying issue is still the OCD. That's the OCD whack-a-mole where it's just pulled. The first thing that came to my mind was a bait and switch, but that's actually not what it is. Whenever you're going through that process and taking care of creating a new response to this, you've probably had this other response that's been there, but it just hasn't been as active as this other one because that's been the main focus, or this has been such a greater response. And I think it's important because I think a lot of people hear that. And, you know, a lot of my experience is in substance abuse and recovery. And a lot of times when you start treating the substance abuse disorder, there's a lot of things that end up showing up and they didn't just show up out of nowhere. And because I don't want people to hear this and be like, oh, well, it sounds like treating my OCD, I could end up, you know, I could end up getting worse with different things. And that's actually not the case. Those things were probably still there. You just might not have recognized them.
Yeah. And I would also say that it's really encouraging when you start to look at the literature in OCD treatment, that if you're willing to go with the evidence-based meds and the evidence-based therapy, we have a response rate of about 80%, which is really huge for mental health.
Right. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
So well, I always encourage people to do a little bit of the reading, because ERP and this exposure thing sounds really scary. Like you made this point about changing some of the aspects about who you are. People with OCD often are very controlled and they're living life in a very deliberate way. And it can be very threatening to a sense of identity to say, hey, your family and friends are so bothered by how rigid you are about these things. Isn't that important mm-hmm. to you? Don't you want to change? They might feel really attacked, but to say you're going to live out your own values in a better way, and it's a highly tolerable treatment. It's not this horrible thing that people drop right. out because we're making you face your worst fears every day. You're the leader of your treatment. That might help people to be more willing to take that leap, find out more information before they write it off.
Right. Well, I'm glad that you said that too. There, this is something of a journey that they go through, it sounds like. But not only that, I could see how it could be so exciting for those of us that are on the outside to see someone going through this. But, you know, if you're listening to this right now and you're diagnosed with OCD, or you know someone that has OCD, or you know, whatever that case may be, we may not necessarily recognize what the other side of that coin looks like, right? Someone that has OCD doesn't really recognize what that looks like. So they might, you're right, they might hear me talking about it like, oh yeah, I'm going to be completely different. No, that doesn't take away who you are. It helps you to have different responses if you choose to, because if you don't choose to, I mean, those other responses are still there, right? If you want to pick them up. And I think that's something that's important, because OCD can have relapse, just like many other mental health disorders. And, you know, that's kind of goes along with what you're saying earlier. We don't take it away. We're just giving you a different type of response. And a lot of times, if stress really comes up or anxiety really comes up, sometimes we can start to reach for those same responses again.
Yes, that is correct. There's a lot of relapse. It's very normal to have to do your own booster ERP or to come back and work with a therapist again when a new content area pops up. But hey, I'm a therapist. I think we should all pop into therapy once in a while anyway. So there's no shame or no harm in that.
Right. Well, and it's funny, we were kind of talking a little bit about this even before we started recording, that if there's anything that has happened during the time of this recording, we're still kind of in the midst of this pandemic. And if there's anything that this pandemic has showed us, at least in this area, is that more people are willing to seek out help for mental health. And that's been, I guess, I don't know if I want to frame it this way, that's been kind of a nice byproduct, is that people are being more willing to take care of, or at least recognize some of these things that are going on with them. I'm kind of sitting here thinking about this and some of the things that we talked about, and I'm wondering, with OCD, I know that, like with anxiety, I like the idea of exposure. I'm a big believer that if you want to change a response to anything, that sometimes you had to be exposed to that, with limits, of course, like trauma not being one of those, but being able to help alter and change a response. I'm wondering, whenever you've worked through and helped a client get through some of these, you know, triggers and some of their responses, can you give us an idea? What does life look like on the other side?
So ideally, life looks like I don't even notice OCD anymore. Ideally, it really does look like, you know, like a cure. We said before, it is a lifelong thing, because it's the way your brain works. It is this process, but I'm not happy with an outcome where a person is still anxious all the time. And that sounds sort of contradictory, because here I am telling people, your anxiety doesn't need to go down. You need to be able to face a situation willingly, willing to feel your anxiety and to see what happens. And if you can improve your willingness to engage in your life, you can improve your lifestyle so that it's more close to your values. it doesn't really matter if your distress goes down in the beginning. And people have to accept that. Part of that poking back at OCD is saying, I don't need this distress to go away right now. That's part of flexibly responding. No matter what shows up for me, I'm going to live my values. But in the long run, that's not good enough. If a patient has been doing this for years and they're still stuck in that high level of distress, it tells me that in some subtle way, they're still resisting. In some subtle way, they're still compulsing, probably either through some avoidance or through mental compulsions that they don't quite understand yet. So recovery should look like recovery.
Right. Well, and that's such a big deal. It looks like that this is something that might not even show up for you. Like you might not even notice it as much.
Right.
And, you know, for someone, let's say, I'm going to throw my wife under the bus here. There was a time where one of her OCD tendencies was towards hand washing. And her working her way through that, it's kind of like, oh, now I don't have to wash my hands 50 times a day. Oh, like now I don't have to put tons of lotion on because my hands was cracking all the time. Even just recognizing that there was something different on the other side of that, or recognizing that like, oh, this isn't even something that has to come up all the time is huge, especially for some people. Like the things that come up are sometimes hugely time constraining. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wonder for you, working through this, I wonder if people going through this type of therapy with you, if this kind of helping them work through some of these OCD tendencies actually shows some positive features in other parts of their life as well.
Oh, absolutely. For so many reasons. OCD can look like ADHD because of how much people avoid their life. So getting through some of the anxiety and some of the rigidity about what you can and can't do has multiple benefits for your career, for your social life, for your hobbies, for your intimate relationships. And it may be that, husband or wife is referred to therapy because the partner is saying, this is intolerable the way they act. And we think it's about some stubborn thing, but when they are able to treat their anxiety about it, their interpersonal relationship improves without us really talking about fair fighting rules or I know you do this, a lot of EFT stuff. So even without worrying about improving all the communication in the couple, just by having the affected person reduce their anxiety, they're able to show up in the relationship in the way that they wanted to.
Right. I think that's so important too, especially like whenever you're talking about gives a person more freedom, more flexibility to kind of do the things they want. Like whenever you say that, I'm thinking about improving relationship, less anxiety. I'm thinking about people that it's easier for them to want to go start a business, right? It's easier for them to like, there's always this hobby that I wanted to try or it's easier for them to be like, hey, you know what? There's this person that I've always wanted to talk to at work, but I just never have. I just want to be able to have more friends, or I want to be part of a game night, or I want to join a softball league or whatever it is. And being able to actually step into some of those desires that they had that they might not have been able to get there before.
Yeah. Craig, can I talk about some of the more taboo content areas?
Oh yeah, definitely. Like you kind of alluded a little bit to some of them earlier, but yes, I think that that's really important for people to recognize.
So really big common taboo areas. And I want to emphasize that these are very common. This is not niche. This is what shows up in my practice every day are religious themes. People avoid going to church because they might have a blasphemous thought in church. So freeing up their anxiety can make them have a fuller relationship with their religion and God. Pedophilic thoughts. We might have thoughts, what if I'm a pedophile, or have a body sensation that made you think that you had an arousal response to seeing a kid. This can lead to a parent not being able to give their kid a bath. This could lead to not being able to show up at the school ground. This could lead to, I guess I can't be a teacher. I guess I can't see my niece and nephew. I can't travel with my family because there's going to be kids on the beach. And so that's an area people don't know a lot about, and it makes huge differences when they can get over it. and sexual orientation. This is so super common that people have these pervasive doubts about their sexual orientation. And I want to be clear that most commonly the fear is not, oh no, I think that I'm gay. The fear is, what if I really don't know my sexual orientation and I'll never know it? And that can be a straight person who doesn't know if they might be gay. That could be a gay person who might not know if they're straight. That could be a teenager who's really just in a questioning phase, who has no idea what their ultimate or sexual orientation is fluid, but they may not really know where they even fall because they haven't done any research exploration. They haven't been informed by a person who knows sexuality well. And so they can't date, they can't do their own exploration. They can't learn about sexuality in a way that will help them to live authentically over time because they're so afraid of approaching those content areas. And those are just three content areas. List goes on and on and on. I mean, I can identify at least 20 content areas that you say, oh, that's OCD. Oh, that's OCD. Oh, that's OCD. Yeah.
I know that even me as someone that doesn't particularly treat OCD, you know, some of those content areas are really something that I think just average therapists see, you know, whether or not, especially like someone, you know, questioning their sexuality, like you said, I can't tell you how many clients that I've had that have watched some part of gay porn and now it's something that they obsess over. Like, oh, because I became aroused during that, does that mean that I have to leave my spouse? And like, does that mean that I should pursue another relationship? And like the train starts and it leaves the station and it doesn't come back. And that's just one, you know, one thing that ends up coming up. Or I've had different people that have watched like gore videos before on the internet. And they're like, I was really interested in that. Does that mean that I, you know, does that mean that I'm going to kill somebody? Or does that mean that I'm going to kill someone I love? Or anything, right? And then the whole thing starts.
These things sound like OCD. The one thing I would say is that it's not the necessarily like the trauma of seeing the gore or the trigger of seeing the gay porn. Most likely in these cases, there are intrusive thoughts that predate these things, and there was testing going on. They looked at the gay porn to see, did I get aroused? And then they're checking their body and now they're questioning their relationship. They looked at the gore video. Maybe it, you know, came up on their Facebook feed or something like that. I don't know what their Facebook feed looks like, but more often we see that they're saying, how am I going to feel when I click this? And they're testing and they're checking. The same as OCD folks check locks to make sure that they know that the door is really locked.
Right.
They check their body in response to seeing these triggers that they think they should have a certain response to. And if they have that response, you know, it's off to the races. If they don't have that response, it's off to the races. If there's uncertainty about that response, it's off to the races. And it happens with the gay porn thing. It happens with the marriage thing. I wanted to, my partner did something to become more intimate to me. And my first reaction felt like I was pulling away. What does this mean? Maybe I'm not supposed to be with my partner. Maybe I don't really love them. No, I do love them. I'm not even good enough to be with them. Oh, now I get reassurance about how good I am. Now I think I'm too good for them. And we get that cycle going. It often starts with the intrusive thought.
Right. I love that you said that too. Like, this is something that you may have wondered before. And that's kind of like the testing ground. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of even thinking off the top of my head, other things that I've seen, whether or not it's been working with like military personnel or police officers that have, you know, that have had to take a life during the line of duty. And one of the common things that happens that people don't ever really talk about is that sometimes whenever, you know, people are in combat situations like that, arousal does happen. And then they start to question, like, is there something wrong with me because this happened? Like, am I, you know, a secret killer that just gets off on this kind of thing? And, you know, then they're off to the races. And it is, I think you're right. It is so much more pervasive. And not only that, I think that people don't often recognize that this is OCD because, you know, there's been media or there's been like, you know, entrenched ideas about, no, this is exactly what OCD looks like, right? Mm-hmm. This is a certain behavior. not realizing that there's actually much more broad.
Yes, the media portrays it in one way, and the reality of it is so much more broad than the way that the media portrays it. However, I have to say it's getting a lot better. But for example, there's a song out in 2021 called Serotonin. I think the artist's name is The Girl in Red, where she talks about her intrusive thoughts about visualizing pushing someone off a train platform onto the tracks. That's not what we think of with OCD, but those are intrusive thoughts. That's OCD. Right. So I think it's getting more popular. And I also want to add that part of the reason that we have these myths that persist is that the therapy for OCD is very specialized. Mm-hmm. And to understand the process of OCD requires a little bit of training. And to throw myself under the bus a little bit, I had 6.5 years of a doctoral program. I had CBT supervisors. I had done exposure therapy. I had direct learning in OCD. I had then moved on and done a postdoc where I had a CBT supervisor. I was doing a lot of good CBT for other sorts of anxiety and depression, but I was seeing OCD cases and I was totally missing the boat. I did not know what I was doing. I told people that they didn't have OCD, where I go back and I say, that is classic, clear OCD. I had people doing all sorts of mental ritualizing because I thought that's what CBT for OCD was like. And it took this postgraduate education that I've done through IOCDF, the International Foundation for Obsessive Compulsive Disorder, and reading. And then also I work for a group practice where the group practice owner, Laura Chakas, she's an OCD specialist. And there's a St. Louis Behavioral Medicine in town has a center for OCD and anxiety related disorders run by Alec Pollard, who's a huge national expert. And right. Doing training with him too, and attending the conferences. It took all of that to get it. It really did. It took talking with more than 50 families with expert education, consultation from people who specialize in this for me to get it. And so part of the reason that it's not broadly understood is because therapists don't get it. Therapists say, I treat OCD without understanding the nature of intrusive thoughts, without understanding how to use exposure, without understanding what CBT for OCD looks like.
Right. Now, I think that what you're saying is really important, because even like our understanding as therapists, OCD has changed over the past 15 years as new research has become available. And as you even said, like even as the DSM, the diagnostic statistic manual that, you know, clinicians use to diagnose people, as some things have shifted with that. And I think that something that's important is that if you're someone that's listening to this and that you have OCD, something that's important is finding a good therapist that does specialize in that. And it's okay to ask, like, all right, well, what kind of education, what kind of background do you have, right? What kind of books do you recommend about this? Finding a therapist that's a good fit is something that's really important.
But, I think the most important question you can ask there is, what percentage of your caseload is currently doing exposure therapy? And if it's not greater than 50%, that person is not specializing in exposure therapy.
Right. Well, and I think that if someone's listening to this and they might have an idea of the true value of working with a specialist, and hopefully even clinicians that are listening to this, they may be working with OCD and they may recognize that they don't truly understand everything that's going on. And, you know, of course we don't. We can't be a specialist in every disorder, right? But we also have to be careful, like how we represent ourselves and yeah. different things that like we're trying and different things that we're doing. And I think like most of us, I'd say that most therapists, they might recognize that this is an area that they're lacking. And it sounds like I'm hearing you say there's a lot of good training and there's a lot of good people that know exactly what they're talking about and good people absolutely. To seek training from. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just like we were talking about before we started recording here, we're all booked. It's real hard to find a provider in town right now, in the St. Louis area, at least, because the demand has been so high. So we're all booked out. Keep trying, keep asking, get on wait lists, be persistent, take your time. It might be better to wait to get into someone who gets you than to just settle for a therapist who you feel like doesn't quite understand OCD yet. And then for the therapists who are interested in more training, IOCDF has really great training. So their training called the Behavioral Therapy Training Institute, the BTTI, is sort of the most well-known. It's very respected. It's just like a weekend long 3-day training, and then you do ongoing consultation with a consultant. You have to present a case during the training. And then there's also the CBI, the Cognitive Behavioral Institute, that has really great 4-day trainings with actual supervision involved in it. And then Mass General Hospital has good webinars where you can learn the basics of it, but you won't get that kind of supervision. So those are good places to start.
Well, and I think too, even kind of talking about those multi-day trainings with supervision and consultation, that's standard for any type of specialization and any type of therapy model that I'm aware of. And I think that, you know, we as clinicians need to hold ourselves to a standard for that. But also, like, if you're listening to this, and it's good to ask the clinician for resources. And if the clinician doesn't have a good idea of books to look into, or, you know, they can't provide you with some of the training or anything that they've had, you know, like Jeremy said, it's okay to look for and wait for someone that actually does specialize in this, since there is nuances to it that you wouldn't normally treat anxiety with. Right. If, you know, like you were talking about the worry earlier, right? If I have somebody that has traditional anxiety, helping present them with evidence contrary to what, you know, what they're anxious about can help them work their way out of this. If that's not doing it for you, then you may not have that type of anxiety, right? Yeah. That may not be what's happening for you.
And to be really direct, if a therapist tries to teach a client how to think their way out of the worry and they're missing OCD, they're actually harming the client. If therapy can help clients, therapy can harm clients. And you can teach people how to compulse. You can confuse them about the process. You can confuse them about what good therapy looks like. And I get numerous patients who have been in therapy for years who come to me and say, oh, this is what it's about. I have patients that have been in therapy for years who might see me for 6 sessions and come out and say, this is more improvement in 6 sessions than I got in years, just because they were missing the boat. And those 6 sessions are a lot about undoing myths if the patient had sort of a mild presentation.
Well, I think something that's important too that I'm hearing you say is, not only like undoing these things, but being in a place where, you know, a lot of this exposure type therapy is actually about approaching the anxiety physically, right? Actually doing it. And if you're actually just talking, right? OCD is mostly thought-based, right? You can't fight thoughts with thoughts. It doesn't work, right? All you're doing is producing more thoughts. And you know what happens when you produce more thoughts? You produce more anxiety. And of course you do, because if you're producing more thoughts, more oxygen has to get to your brain, more mental resources has to be produced. So whenever that happens, your body's going to amp up. And if your body amps up, it's going to start taking resources away from the smartest part of your brain, because it's amping up your body and it's activating your stress response, which if you're interested, you can go listen to previous episodes that we talked about anxiety and the stress response. The same thing happens. You cannot fight thoughts with thoughts. If this is something that you're presenting with, it doesn't work. You actually have to go through and physically do something different. And if you don't physically do something different and you don't have that plan, that structure that Jeremy's talking about, then you're just going to keep doing the same thing that you've been doing.
Can I make one more point here about these thoughts? Yeah, and engaging with these thoughts. Thinking more leads to thinking more. So I've been talking about this concept of intrusive thoughts, a what-if statement, a worry, an image, an urge, a sensation in your body. So I want to give some analogies that are some of my favorite ways of describing what these intrusive thoughts are and how we're supposed to respond to them.
Perfect.
So we're doing all these Zoom therapy sessions right now, but what I'll do for for people during the Zoom therapy session, it's like hold up a post-it note, like a thought bubble over my head and say, I was walking along and then all of a sudden out of nowhere, pop, there goes a thought. It's in my head. I have no control over this thought bubble popping up. It's going to pop up no matter what I want to say or do. But then if I start examining it and I pull the post-it note in front of me and I'm looking at it and I'm touching it and I'm questioning it, and I'm writing on it and I'm analyzing it.
Right.
Now I've fed into that. I've reinforced that intrusive thought. It's more likely to come back next time because I engaged with it. So we want to learn non-engagement. So here's my analogies for non-engagement. Imagine that you're walking down a dark street and it's kind of creepy and you see some unsavory character who looks like they might be dangerous and they're muttering to themselves and they're going to cross paths with you and you're frightened of them. And as you walk by them, they say into your ear the most horrific, vile, horrible, mean, evil thing you could ever imagine. Do you stop and do you say, what did you just say to me? Or do you keep walking because you don't want to engage with that guy?
Right.
OCD throws that what if thought in your brain, throws that your horrible thought in your brain. And if you stop and say, I know I'm not horrible, you just encouraged it to keep talking back to you.
Right.
Another favorite analogy here. These are all from Sally Winston, by the way. She's got this great clinic in Maryland with some superstar clinicians under her. And she's written some great books on this as well. The next analogy is you're in an apartment and it's a two-bedroom apartment. One of the bedrooms is the one you sleep in and the other one has nothing in it but a flat panel TV that's built into the wall. And it's got no buttons, it's got no remote. You can't change it, but it's playing the thought channel. And sometimes it's benign, and sometimes it's really troublesome stuff, and sometimes it's quiet, and sometimes it's loud. And so you're trying to live and work and enjoy your life and sleep. And sometimes you can't hear it, and sometimes it's super loud. And in the beginning, you would go into the room and you would try to fiddle with the TV and you know that there's no remote, you know that there's no buttons, but you're so desperate, you keep trying anyway. And the goal is, I'm just going to pretend that it's not even happening. I'm going to spend zero time in that room. If it's keeping me awake at night, I'm trying to sleep. If it's keeping me from working, I'm trying to work. I'm not trying to deal with these intrusive thoughts. And then the last of these analogies has to do with awareness versus attention, because we can't get these intrusive thoughts out of our awareness. They're just going to keep popping in no matter how much you try to resist it, but we don't have to engage with them. So if you're driving along and a truck in front of you throws a clod of mud onto your windshield and it's gross and it's obscuring kind of part of the view and you can't see, you can see the road in front of you, but the clod of mud is blocking some of it. You can't get that mud out of your awareness. It's going to be in your field of vision, but you want to look past the mud and put your attention on the road. You can't stop your awareness, but you can control your attention. If you turn on the windshield wipers to try to get that mud off, it's going to smear it all over the windshield. We have to let it dry out. We'll get to the gas station and we'll peel it off then. In this case, we're not even going to peel it off later. It's going to dry off and flake away in the breeze.
Right.
That's how we're going to handle this. So it's all about non-engagement with intrusive thoughts. That is a huge part of the RP plan. It's when we say, what are you going to do? It's not just, I'm not going to disinfect the refrigerator. It's the, I'm not going to tell myself I'm horrible in response to this thought. I'm not going to figure out why this thought is not true. I'm not going to figure out how I truly think and feel. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say, maybe I am, maybe I'm not. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, and move on from there. The less we say, the less we reinforce.
And I love that you said, I love the metaphors you use. I know the metaphor I've always used is like our thoughts are like on a conveyor belt, and any thought that you take and you pick up and you examine, that's giving more attention to that thought. And then, you know, you're not paying attention to the conveyor belt anymore, but that thought becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. As you pay attention to it more and more and more, it's more likely to show up on the conveyor belt again later on.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to kind of watch those thoughts go by without picking them up is something that's really challenging. Like you said, mm-hmm. like it's the mud on the windshield. Mm-hmm. And I know how most of us get whenever we get something on our windshield, we want to do the wipers, like you said, but a lot of times it can just smear it and it can make it so much worse because we're giving attention to those thoughts. I think that you described that perfectly.
I want to even add one piece of nuance to your conveyor belt analogy, which I really love, and I use a similar one. A lot of people have heard of clouds in the sky or leaves on the stream. When we have a disturbing thought, we just let it come into our awareness. We let it float downstream until it's gone, and we're not messing with it. We're just letting it leave. But sometimes people think that means they're supposed to watch that cloud the whole way across the sky. They're supposed to watch that leaf all the way right. down the stream. If we know that the conveyor belt is a circle, it makes no sense to track it the whole way. We just notice it, and then we put our attention on other things. Mm-hmm. When we're learning that we shouldn't resist our thoughts, it doesn't mean that we have free rein to engage in analytical commentary about these thoughts. That's a different thing than saying, I'm just allowing this thought into my head. I don't want the commentary, just the thought.
Right. I like that you said that, like, if I'm watching it go by on the conveyor belt, that's still me giving it attention.
Yeah.
Like, that's still the intrusive thought doing exactly what it was trying to do, which is intrude on my life. And I think that you said a lot of this actually starts with these intrusive thoughts.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people that are listening to this, they can start to recognize that. So, Jeremy, I appreciate you coming on here. I wonder if someone's listening to this and they're like, hey, like, I like Jeremy. He has said a lot of important things, or I have some questions for Jeremy, or I would want to reach out and connect with Jeremy. What's the best way that they could reach you?
Shoot me an email, jeremy@mindfulstl.com, and I can help you out. I am completely full for taking new patients, but often I'll offer a brief consult to try to point you in the right direction of the kind of therapy that you might want, or help direct people to out of town resources if they need some inpatient treatment or things like that. So I'm happy to field some emails if people need a little bit of advice on that stuff.
Perfect. Again, Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us and helping us understand OCD a little more. And thank you all of us for joining us for this episode of Mental Health Insights. Mental Health Insights is a product of Life Care Counseling. If you like this episode, I'd ask that you would hop on whatever podcasting app you're listening to and give us a 5-star review. That way, other people can find us and they could get access to this cool, free resource. Thank you, and I wish you all well. Thank you for listening to our show. This podcast is designed to provide accurate and reliable information, and those that appear on the show are all licensed professionals in the area of mental health counseling. We are in no way rendering legal or medical advice, only information to help serve you better in making decisions in your life. If you need a professional, you should find one. Music you are listening to is called Lobby Time, and that is by Kevin MacLeod and licensed through Creative Commons.